Welcome to all of you. Thank you so much for joining the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council's program featuring our esteemed guests. We have Dr. Augusto Lopez Claros, who is going to join us remotely, and Dr. Todd Knopp, you're welcome.
Noop.
Thank you. My name is Sunday Goshit. I am an ICFRC board member and your host for today's program. As a reminder, we plan for this program to go until 7:30. Today is the ninth program in our fall 2025 lineup. We're deeply grateful for the long-standing support from our community. Your help has allowed our organization to grow for 42 years, hosting speaker programs with experts joining us in person and online from across the world. As a small nonprofit, we exist because of the generosity of individuals like you. As we head last month of 2025, opportunities for nonprofit funding beyond individuals are becoming more difficult as charitable organizations like ours face an uncertain future, especially when focused on uplifting research and stories advocating for marginalized, vulnerable, and international communities. Please consider making a donation. You can do this by cash or check with the QR code on the tables in the room or on the screen behind me, or by visiting our website. Help us keep our free educational programs available over the next year. This and attending our programs is a tangible way you can be actionable in and help make a difference amidst these challenging times. Iowa City Foreign Relations Council would like to give a heartfelt thank you to today's sponsor and partner, the Iowa City Public Library, for providing partnership space and today's food. Our next program will be next Friday, November the 7th at 11:30 a.m., right here in the Public Library. This program is titled Glocal at Iowa, Me, Iowa, and the World. To celebrate International Education Week, this program features students speaking about their most meaningful glocal, where how the global and the local intersect experiences while at the University of Iowa. Using the unique presentation style of pecha kucha, meaning chit-chat in Japanese, presenters will have 6 minutes to share 20 timed slides. Their stories and images focus on culture and curiosity from the diverse perspectives and the lessons they have learned about life as students in a wide world. A panel discussion with question and answers would follow the presentations. Today's program and our final program, How Does Too Much Presidential Power Endanger Democracy, on November 14th, are part of our fall 2025 four-part series, Big Questions Confronting 2025. There are posters on your tables and on our website where you can find more information. Now, with that, I would like to introduce our speakers. Dr. Augusto Lopez Claros is an international economist and the Executive Director of Global Governance Forum. He has published several books on global governance reform and is currently spearheading the Global Governance Forum's drafting of a second United Nations Charter. He brings more than 30 years of experience in international organizations, including most recently as Director of the Global Indicators Group at the World Bank, one of the departments within the bank's research vice presidency. Previously, he was chief economist at the World Economic Forum, where he directed the Global Competitiveness Program and edited the Global Competitiveness Report, the forum's flagship publication. Before joining the forum, he worked for several years in the financial sector in London with a special focus on emerging markets. He was the International Monetary Fund's resident representative in Russia during the 1990s. He has also been a senior fellow at the Edmund Walsh School of Foreign Service at George Washington University. Educated in England and the United States, he received a diploma in mathematical statistics from Cambridge University and a PhD in economics from Duke University. Recent publications include Removing Impediments to Sustainable Economic Development, The Case of Corruption, published in 2015, Equality for Women, Prosperity for All in 2018, and then Global Governance and the Emergence of Global Institutions for the 21st Century, published in 2020 in the Cambridge University Press. His book, Global Governance and International Cooperation, Managing Global Catastrophic Risks in the 21st Century, co-edited with Richard Falk, has just been published by Routledge in 2024. He has lectured at some of the world's leading universities, think tanks, and international organizations. Well, great. Okay. Dr. Todd and Dr. Lopez is going to join us virtually. Dr. Todd Noop is Associate Professor of Economics and Business at Cornell College, where his primary research and teaching interests include macroeconomic theory, tax reform, and monetary policy. He has published many articles in such journals as Economic Inquiry and Southern Economic Journal. Noop's most recent book is entitled Bigger Pies and Just Desserts, Understanding Economic Inequality. He holds a PhD in economics from Purdue University, as well as an MA in economics and a BA in economics and finance from Miami University. Please join me in welcoming these amazing speakers that we have today. And I'll pass it on to Nick. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Sunday. Can you hear me okay? Yeah, great. So, well, thank you all for coming out on a Wednesday night to talk about the uplifting topic of economic inequality. Yes, right, it's not exactly a happy topic, but I think as we talk tonight, and I think my guess is that the fact that you're here, you probably already believe this, that economic inequality is really one of the things that's underpinning a lot of the discussions and the conflict that are going on, not just in the United States, but across the globe. And so I want to talk a little bit about that tonight. And so my part of the program is really going to try to address two questions. First off, what's happening to economic inequality, right? What does the data say? And so while I'll spend a lot of time talking about the United States, one of the things that I will emphasize is that what's happening in the U.S. is happening in most developed and developing countries, right? To a greater or lesser extent, but we see these similar sorts of patterns emerging across the globe. The second question that I'll talk a little bit about here tonight is what is driving this increase in economic inequality? And once again, I think very much similar patterns across countries are driving what's the increase in inequality, just like we're seeing in the U.S. A recent survey asked Americans how much more the average CEO is paid than the average worker. Americans, the average answer was 30, right? That the average CEO is paid 30 times more than the average worker. What is the answer? 399, right? And this is not just Americans, right? Another survey looked across 40 countries and found across all 40 countries that people consistently underestimated the amount of inequality within their country, right? So how unequal are we, right? How do we understand the amount of inequality in the U.S. and across the globe? Well, I think there's really four facts that we can focus on. First, income inequality has risen significantly in the U.S. since 1980. So this picture here is of the Gini coefficient, and I'm not going to get into the details of what the Gini coefficient is. It's fairly technical, but you can think about it as a number between 0 and 1, where zero would be perfect equality. Everybody in a country had this exact same amount. And one would be perfect inequality, in which one person owned everything. Okay? Now, the actual number of the Gini coefficient doesn't really make much difference. Where the Gini coefficient really has interesting information for us is to track what's happening to it over time. And so here you can see the Gini coefficient in the United States between 1920 and 2020. And I think there's a couple of really interesting things here to note. First off, I think a lot of people have this idea that inequality is inexorable, right? It's always been, and it's always gotten worse. In fact, that is not what we see, right? In fact, if you notice here, this period between 1940 and 1980, often called the Great Compression, was a period of relative equality, and not just in the United States, but many countries, particularly in developed countries, saw a very similar pattern of lower inequality during this period. So inequality changes over time. But you'll notice here in our recent era, and the recent era really can be, you know, dated at 1980, when something changed, right? That Great Compression period ended, and inequality has steadily risen since 1980, really to levels that we haven't seen since the Gilded Era of the 1920s, right? As I said, exactly what this graph looks like in different countries is slightly different. But across almost nearly all developed countries and most developing countries, you will see a similar pattern in their Gini coefficient. What's really going on, though, is what's happening at the very top, right? The top 10%, the top 1%, the top 0.1%, and the top 0.01%, right? That is really what is unusual about this era of globalization, that people at the top are very much pulling away. So there's a lot of information here in this table, right? But I think the story that it tells is quite shocking. So in each column here, we have, once again, this is US data, but looking at average income for the bottom 50%, the top 1%, the top 0.1%, and the top 0.01%. So for instance, the bottom 50%, they have an average income of about $28,000, and there's 92 million households that fall in that category. Compare this to the top 0.01%, right, where the average income is 36 million, there's about 18,000 households in this category. But look what's happened across these different categories as we move from 1980 to 2020, right? The bottom 50% has seen a modest increase in growth over these 40 years of 44%. But if we look at the top 1%, 252% increase. The top 0.1%, 384% increase. The top 0.01%, that's 18,000 households, 524% increase. If you put this in dollar figures, right, the statistics are quite shocking, right? That average household in the top 0.01% has seen their income change by 32 million. Well, for the bottom 50%, $8,500, right? If you think about this in terms of share of income, so in other words, if the US economy is the pie, how big is the slice that everybody is getting? We now see that beginning in 1990, roughly, the early 90s, that now the top 1% earns more income than the bottom 50% of Americans. And that gap is getting wider and wider every year. It's not just income inequality, though, that is driving overall inequality. If you think income inequality is bad, well, wait till you hear some statistics about wealth inequality, because it's even worse, right? It's even worse. If we think about this globally, right, and wealth is a global phenomena, the wealthiest 1% own almost half of the global wealth, right? So 1% of the population owns as much as 3.5 billion people. The least wealthy half of the world's population, as I said, owns a little bit less than 1% of global wealth. The U.S. is the most unequal industrialized country in terms of wealth, and it's getting more so, right? In the U.S., the share of wealth going to the wealthiest 1% went from 23% to 37%, right, since 1980, right? So I'll say that again. 1% of the population owns about 37% of the wealth in the United States. And if you go up to the very, very tip top, right, the Forbes 400, right, the 25 wealthiest on the Forbes 400 list own more than the bottom half of the U.S. population, right? 25 people own more wealth than half of the U.S. population. The Forbes 400 members have as much wealth as all African Americans plus one-fourth of American Latino population combined, right? And you can just keep on going on and on. I've cut this down to a couple of fun facts, right? But we can continue, however you want to parse this, right? The statistics are quite shocking. The last part of this, the last fact, is that the middle class is shrinking, right? And there's this sense that economic mobility is stagnant, right? I think traditionally Americans have been willing to accept some level of inequality with the hope that, well, you know, if you work hard and play by the rules, you will get ahead, right? That somebody who is poor today could potentially become rich in the future. I think your sense, and this is probably my sense, is that that belief is very much declining, and there's good reasons to think that people's loss of sense in this equality of opportunity reflects what's actually happening in their lives. If you look at the percentage of the population that's defined as the middle class in rich countries, it has shrunk across all rich democracies, right? Where has the shrinkage been the largest? In the countries that have the most inequality, namely the U.S. and the U.K. of these countries are the countries that are the most unequal. They're also the countries that have seen their middle class shrink by the most. If you want to think about the dissatisfaction of the American middle class, I really think you have to think about it in two ways. One is that the middle class sees their prospects falling, right? And so once again, here's a graph that's looking at income share. So if you think about the economy as a pie, who's getting what size of slice, right? If you look at the top, at the blue line, the middle 40%, right, the middle class, their share of the pie is shrinking over time. If we look at the bottom 50%, though, that number is actually relatively constant, right? But still, if the bottom 50% is staying the same, but the middle 40% is shrinking, as I think about this, what's happening to the middle 40% is they see the people at the top pulling away, and they see the people at the bottom getting closer and closer to where they are, right? And I think that's a lot of how you have to think about this dissatisfaction that a lot of people in the middle class in the U.S. and in other developing countries feel today. Okay, I want to show you one more graph. Now, this graph might be particularly interesting to economists, but I'll try to convince you here that this is a very important graph as we think about why all this is happening. This is looking at the growth of labor productivity, okay? How productive labor is. And then it's looking at wages of workers, okay? Classical economic theory says that higher productivity should lead to higher wages, right? So when workers get more productive, they get paid more. And if you look at these two lines, you'll see up until about 1980, that was relatively true, that when labor productivity went up, wages went up at very close to the same percentage. But look what's happened since 1980, right? There's been a schism between these two things. Labor productivity has continued to rise solidly, but wage growth has fallen behind, right? Economists like to believe that labor productivity kind of raises all ships, right? But that's not what we're seeing. Productivity continues to grow apace, but wage growth has fallen behind, right? So if I can kind of sum up our kind of preliminary answers to this first question about what's happening to inequality in the U.S. and other developed countries, I'll focus on just a couple of things here to review. First off, income inequality across the globe has been going up since 1980, right? 1980 is kind of a magic date, right, in the study of inequality. Something unusual is happening at the very top, right? Where do we see the biggest differences is what's happening up there at the very top of the distribution. The middle class is shrinking, right? The middle class is shrinking, and their relative performance relative to both the bottom and the top has declined. And then finally, this link between greater productivity and greater wages is broken, right? And so, you know, that's kind of my summary for that first question of what's happening to inequality. So let's move to the second question here. Why? Right? Why is this happening? So I got to tell you, there is no simple answer here, right? And it is not just one thing, okay? So this is, I would say, you know, to understand deeply why inequality is increasing would take much more than the, you know, short time that we have here tonight. But I do want to focus on a couple of big ideas that I would like you to take away from this talk in terms of why inequality is changing. And the three big things that have changed is our economics are changing, our families are changing, and our social institutions are changing. And each of these are changing in ways that are related to each other, right? So for instance, our economics is changing the nature of our families and our social institutions. Our families are changing in ways that changes both the economics of how we live, but also our social institutions, right? And so I'll try to explain briefly how these three things are interrelated. But let's begin with, you know, what I find the most interesting, the economics, right? What exactly has changed in our economy? I would say that if we wanted to put our finger on one thing, it is the ideas-driven economy that we have today is much different than the economy that we had in 1980 or before, right? Very much, we have an economy that is driven by ideas. And the economics of ideas is much different than the economics of producing physical things, okay? So look what's happened in the U.S. economy when it comes to service jobs relative to manufacturing jobs, right? Manufacturing jobs are flat or declining here since 1940. What has increased? Service jobs, okay? And I think when most of us hear service jobs, we think, well, you know, somebody flipping hamburgers at McDonald's, right? But if you think about what, and I'm going to imagine most of our jobs in this room are, they are service jobs, right? They are service jobs. They're jobs that have very little to do with the actual production of physical things. They're jobs that have to do with the production of services and often the providing of ideas, right? This economy is much different than the way we traditionally think about economics, right? So, you know, traditionally, if you think about making a hamburger, right, hamburgers have certain properties, right? There's a physical component to it. Hamburgers need to be remade every time somebody wants to have a hamburger. And very importantly, if I eat the hamburger, you can't eat the hamburger, right? Ideas do not share those same properties as hamburgers, right? First off, ideas only have to be made once, right? And oftentimes they're not made with physical inputs, they're made with human inputs. Also, one of the very important things about ideas is that once you make them once, you never have to make them again, meaning that they can be easily shared, right? And so those basic kind of economic differences between services and manufactured goods drive a lot of what we're seeing in our economy today, right? Because what have we seen since 1980? Almost all of the growth in wages has been for college-educated workers, right? Why have college-educated workers become such a premium? Because when it comes to providing services, services tend to be highly cognitive and non-routine. Basically, what that means is that they require a lot of human capital, right? A lot of education. And so basically, when we say an ideas-intensive economy, what we're talking about is a human capital or an education-intensive economy, is the economy that we have today. This has put a very large premium on workers that have more human capital, more education. And so you can see here in this graph that if you look since 1973, if we look at the wages for those that have less than a high school or high school education, they're flat or declining, right? All of the wage growth has been for college-educated workers, right? The gap between the high school-educated and the college-educated worker has gone up by 60% since 1980, right? So this is what economists call skills-based technological change, right? That technological change is happening, and it's very skills-based. And one of the problems is you might say, well, isn't the solution to this we have more educated workers? Well, sure, that is a solution, but there's a big problem. Technology changes a lot faster than education can change, right? All right, our ability to accumulate education throughout the population, throughout the labor force, is a very, very slow process. So for those of you who've taken an econ class, if you kind of visualize a labor demand, labor supply curve, right? Labor demand for these educated workers is going way up, but labor supply is changing very slowly. That drives up wages for these college-educated workers, and that's driving a lot of the inequality that we're observing. But it's more than this, okay? Ideas in our ideas-based economy is not just working through education. It's also working through the nature of markets themselves, right? In ideas-based economy, we tend to get winner-take-all monopolies, right? There is a big advantage in idea markets for being the biggest and being the first. So Google owns 90% of the online share market. Microsoft provides operating systems for 70% of the world's computers. Apple and Samsung control 60% of the world's cell phone markets. Facebook and Google control about 65% of online advertisement. Amazon controls 40% of America's online retailing and about 77% of book sales, right? We see the creation of what economists would call a natural monopoly. The way that these markets, right, operate in ideas, right, is once you produce an idea, you only have to produce it once, right? And so, you know, if you think about Google, what makes Google so powerful is both that they have an idea, but that everybody uses Google, right? There's a huge first mover advantage to being the first in the market, to having everybody work with it. And the same for all these companies, right? The more people that they use it, the more power they grow. The more power they grow, the more people they use it, right? This has had a very important impact on inequality, because what we see is that what's true about the workers who work in these monopolies? They get paid a lot more than the workers in similar jobs who do not work for these monopolies, right? Recent data suggests that wage variation between people with similar jobs has accounted for 40% of the increase in income inequality in the United States. Okay, so let me say that again. Across people with similar jobs, we're seeing more wage inequality, right? A lot of that has to do with where you work. If you work one of the companies that's successful, you get higher wages. If you don't, you don't, right? So there's a lot more wage variation across jobs, even similar jobs, right? Who you work for, right? One final thing that's occurring here in labor markets particularly is what we would call the economics of superstars, right? That markets have evolved in ways that people who have unique skills can take a huge share of the gains from trade. So I don't know if anybody saw the last Tom Cruise movie, the Mission Impossible movie. Tom Cruise got paid $120 million for that movie. Now, based on Tom Cruise's acting ability, would we say that he was worth $120 million? No, I certainly wouldn't, right? I thought Humphrey Bogart was a better actor. Did Humphrey Bogart get paid $120 million a movie? No, but of course, a movie back in the 1930s was something much different than a movie today, right? Is Tom Cruise worth $120 million? He might be, because what does Tom Cruise do? He sells movies in China. He sells movies in Vietnam. His movies get on Happy Meals at McDonald's, right? They get streamed on major platforms. There's all the cross-marketing and cross-merchandising that happens in modern ideas-based economies, right? And so those workers with unique skills, right, can create huge gains for themselves. And there's been a lot of research that suggests that in particular industries, in particular, these economics of superstars is driving a lot of inequality, particularly in sports, entertainment, finance, and the law, right? Those four big areas, right, are large, we've seen huge increases in inequality, particularly for those at the very top of their fields, right? Largely probably driven by this economics of superstars idea. So while this isn't an explanation, certainly, of everything that's going on in the U.S., it does help us understand what's happening up there at the very tip top. Something else that's changed on our economy is globalization, right? And I don't think I have to explain this to anybody in this room. We kind of understand this, right? Globalization and international trade, it is a technology. It's a technology, right? What are we able to do here in Iowa? We're able to turn soybeans into computer chips. It's a technology. But like most of the technology that we've seen over the last 40 years, it's increasing inequality. Why? Because the areas that we tend to specialize in tend to be more human capital education intensive. And so once again, trade and globalization, modern globalization, tends to create big winners, and then it tends to create losers, right? Those workers that have worked in industries for which the U.S. is not competitive in. Modern globalization, right, doesn't take place in the same way that it took place, you know, 50 years ago, right? Very little trade nowadays is final goods for final goods, right? What we're seeing in modern globalization are these global supply chains, right? Where countries are not trading final goods, they're trading all of these intermediate goods, right? And so this is a Boeing 787 Dreamliner, and you can see the vast amount, I'm sure this doesn't even come close to capturing the complexity of all of the parts that go into this and where they all come from. And so you can see here, you know, even this, I think, graph gives you an idea that it's very difficult to separate technological innovation from globalization. They really are, in some ways, left hand and the right hand, right? They go together. But just in the ways that we talked about technology growth in an ideas-based economy, increasing inequality, well, globalization is likely increasing inequality in the same way. Here you can see the U.S. real value added in manufacturing has risen while employment in manufacturing has fallen, right? And so that's, in many ways, this is exactly what's happened one of the consequences of globalization, right, is that in many ways the U.S. is producing more manufactured goods than we ever have before, but of course the trick is we're doing it with less people, right? And that is at the crux of a lot of the economic insecurity that a lot of people have felt here over the last few years. Let me move on away from the economics and just kind of talk a little bit about some other factors that are driving inequality. Let's talk about family structure, because I think family structure is an underappreciated driver of economic inequality. What we are getting today is what economists call assortive mating. Okay? So what is assortive mating? Back in the 1950s, the education of a male, and back in the 1950s they were only studying male-female marriages, but the education level of a man in a relationship was negatively related with the education of the woman in a relationship. That has completely changed, right? Today in the U.S., right, if you look at marriages, the education level between partners in a marriage is more highly correlated than the height of a children is correlated with the height of their parents, okay? So there is this immense amount of correlation between the education levels of partners in marriages, right? That's having a lot of very surprising effects or unanticipated effects, right? First off, because we measure inequality by household, right? That's how we tend to think about income inequality. So when you have a household in which you have two highly educated partners, both of those highly educated partners are likely also to be highly paid. And if they're highly paid, that certainly is going to be creating some inequality. But we're seeing this trickle down in other ways. Right, the marriage gap between college-educated people and non-college-educated people is growing. Right, if we look at college-educated adults, right, there has been a slight decline in marriage rates. But if we look at those who have high school or less, there has been a dramatic decline in marriage rates. Right. It's not, though, just that there's these declines in marriage rates. It's also, right, while there's been a decline in marriage rates among those who have a high school education or less, there's also been a very large increase in divorce rates among those who have a high school or less education. And so what's the implication of this? The implication of this is that a woman without a college education is 5 times more likely to be a single parent than a woman who has a college education. Right? I'll say that again. A woman without a college education is 5 times more likely to be a single parent than a woman with a college education. And so that has a lot of trickle-down effects in our economy, particularly on things like child rearing, right? Mothers that do not have a college degree spend more time working and less time with their children, about 45 minutes less a day, right? There are studies that show that parents who have high-income, high-education parents hear about 3.5 hours more words a week than children from parents that do not have as high education or income levels, right? These variations in parenting are explaining a huge portion of the variation that we see in child test scores in school, right? And so at the same time that we have this more education-driven economy, what are we seeing, right? That more and more kids are being essentially kind of closed out of access to education, in part because of, you know, their family situations. This is an amazing graph. This is looking at the correlation between parental income and the access to higher education of their children. It's almost a perfect relationship, right? So the richer your parents are, the more access you get to higher education, right? Plain and simple. This relationship exists across the world, but is particularly strong in the United States, right? So the correlation between a child's education and a parent's education is much stronger than the correlation between a child's height and a parent's height, right? To give you some idea of how closely correlated education levels are between parents and children, right? And so, you know, we see this time and time again. In the United States, poor students with high test scores are about as likely to go to college as the children of rich parents with low test scores, right? So in other words, if you want to say what is a child's opportunity to go to college, it's very, very highly correlated with parents' income, right? And so that obviously is playing a huge role in income mobility, right, and access to you know, the better life. Let me just end here by saying our social institutions are changing too. And here I don't think I have to say a lot, because I'm going to imagine that most of us here in this room understand that money is changing our politics and it's changing our society, right? The last election, the top 50 political donors contributed half of all the money spent in the campaign. 50 donors contributed half of all money spent in the political campaign. That's over $2.5 billion, right? And so you see this in an infinite number of ways in our politics and in our policy. Let me just briefly talk about tax rates, right? Look what's happened to the progressivity of the U.S. tax code over time. If we went back to 1960, you'd see this big difference between the average or the marginal tax rate paid by the top 0.01% and what was paid by the bottom 50%. But look what's happened to that gap. It is shrinking over time, right? And this is not something that's happening just in the U.S. Once again, studies have shown that across developed democracies, we're seeing these same sorts of effects, right? Our tax codes are becoming less progressive. If you actually look at the U.S. tax code, we essentially have a flat tax system now, right? In fact, it's maybe something worse than a flat tax system, because who pays the most? It's usually the middle class, right? And I think this is part of the reason why a lot of people in the middle class feel like they're being overly taxed. But of course, what's true about most of the tax cuts that are passed? The benefits are mainly accrued to those who are in the top 1% or the top 0.1%, right? And so you see, like, the group here that sticks out particularly is, you know, those people at the very, very top are paying some of the highest tax rates. But outside of that top 1%, we have something that's very similar to a flat tax rate. For the first time in U.S. history, labor is being taxed more than capital, and that's not an accident, right? Wealth is being taxed less than labor, right? And that's not an accident. It reflects the realities of policy and how our policy is made in the United States. So what's driving inequality, right? It's these feedback loops between changes in our economics, changes in our families, and changes in our political and social institutions, right? These feedback loops between them, and in this case, mainly negative feedback loops, in which, you know, changes in our economics is making our economy less equal, but it's also making our family structures and our social institutions less equal. We shouldn't be surprised by this. 2,400 years ago, Plato said that inequality is the greatest of all plagues. He would know. He lived through the plague of Athens, in which 40% of the population died. Right? So think about that. He lived in a time when 40% of the population died, and he said what's worse is inequality, right? Because it weakens the social institutions. It weakens that social fabric. It leads to increasing political and economic power, and it leads to polarization between those who have and have not, right? And so if you ever are curious about this, you can do a little internet search on Plato and inequality, and it's a little scary about some of the things that Plato had to say and how much it sounds like he could be talking about Athens 2,400 years ago, or he could be talking about our country or in other countries across the world today. So, with that said, I've probably gone a little bit long. I apologize, Augusto. I would like to turn it over to Augusto, and Augusto's going to solve all of our problems and tell us exactly how we solve this issue.
Thank you, Todd. Thank you very much for that very interesting, insightful presentation. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I wanted to begin by sharing with you a very interesting data. The global economy over the last 60 years has grown by something like 2.1% per year in real terms. And one of the consequences of this sustained growth or expansion has been a remarkable evolution of a number of social indicators. You can see, for instance, on the upper right-hand corner that average life expectancy has increased from 52 years in 1960 to 72 years in 2020. It's probably a little higher by now. You can see that infant mortality, this is the bottom left-hand corner, infant mortality has also come down in a big, big way. Of course, this is an average number for all the countries in the world for which we have data. It is still the case that infant mortality is very high in some low-income countries in Africa, in India, and so on. But you can see that the average, it has certainly come down in a big way. let's go to the next slide. On the next slide, you have a very remarkable reduction in extreme poverty. The World Bank, which is the organization that collects the data on extreme poverty, uses a very austere poverty line of $2.15 a day of income. And so if your income is below $2.15, you're classified as being extremely poor. And I say austere because that essentially means that you live on the edge of survival. Being extremely poor is not something that you would wish on your worst enemy. It means that if you're a woman and your husband loses his job, your children are not likely to have anything to eat the following day. It means that your family is not contributing to a social security scheme, probably has no access to electricity and very limited access to basic services. And yet, the story that this graph tells you is that, especially if you extrapolate backwards in time this green line, it turns out that in 1990, in other words, 25 years before the first point in this graph, the number of extremely poor people in the world was close to 2 billion. And as you can see, there has been a steady decline year after year after year. This chart begins in 2015, but just imagine if I had done it from 1990, you would see this line coming down. And by 2019, it had come down to something like 650 million, which is still a high number, but, you know, it's at that time, it was probably 10% of the world's population. And so many economists, including many of my colleagues at the World Bank, would tell you, this is great success. It's a great story. We have really made great strides in reducing the incidence of extreme poverty. And what this graph also tells you is that that progress was reversed as a result of COVID. You see that yellow dotted line after 2019, you saw a very sharp increase in extreme poverty the following year because of the lockdowns and you know, the implosion of the global economy, in fact, as a result of the pandemic. The next slide is a slightly different take on the same data. If you look at the bottom graph, it shows you that the impact of COVID is expected to be sustained long term. In other words, by 2030, we're still going to have something like 500 or plus extremely poor people, which means that the Sustainable Development Goal number one, if you're familiar with the so-called SDGs, the first goal of the 17 SDGs is the elimination of extreme poverty by 2030, and this is not going to happen. This chart does not include the impact of the Russia-Ukraine war in 2022, which essentially compounded the impact of COVID because it led to increases in energy prices, increases in the prices of important commodities like corn, like wheat, and so on. So a combination of COVID and the Russian invasion of Ukraine has had a very deleterious impact on poverty. Okay, so I'm going to shift gears in a second, but let me just show you one more graph, the next one, which shows you the distribution of extreme poverty in the world. This is, I'm not sure that you can see from where you're sitting, but you can see that the blue side of this chart on the right-hand side are countries in sub-Saharan Africa. So more than half of the extremely poor people live in sub-Saharan Africa. The blue on the left-hand side is South Asia, and you can see, therefore, that India is the country that, in absolute terms, has the highest number of extremely poor people in the world. Okay, now, let's skip and go to the, not the next, but the next to the next slide. Two more, one more. Yeah. All right. So I'm going to shift gears. I wanted to give you a little bit of that background on poverty because it helps to understand a little bit better some of the very interesting data that I will show you, some of which involves a little bit of a sort of simulation. All right. So this is one take on world inequality, all right? Todd gave us a very interesting perspective, especially focused on the U.S., although he did say that many of the data that he was showing also could be replicated in other countries, especially high-income countries. But here, what I show you, this is for 2021, but it doesn't change if we had put together this data for 2024, say. You have the GDP for sub-Saharan Africa being essentially $1.9 trillion. And then you have the GDP of, I'm going to focus on Switzerland and Netherlands. Switzerland has a GDP of 800 billion, Netherlands a GDP of about 1 trillion. And what's really interesting is that if you add the GDPs of Switzerland and Netherlands, it's about the equivalent of GDP of sub-Saharan Africa, which is a group of some 50 countries. And then on the right-hand side, you can see the population. Sub-Saharan Africa has a population of about 1.2 billion, whereas the population of Switzerland and Netherlands, which are two relatively, I would say, middling, not particularly large European countries, the combined population of these two countries is 26 million, which is about 2.2% of the population of sub-Saharan Africa, right? So this gives you a sense of the concentration of GDP, if you wish, the concentration of wealth in the world, and you know, two countries with a fairly small population have the same GDP, broadly speaking, as the entire sub-Saharan Africa continent with 1.2 billion people. I won't go over the Australia and the Spanish data, but it tells essentially the same story. Let's go to the next slide. Here, this is looking at historical data, and if you go back to 1870s, which think of it as you know, the sort of early phase of the Industrial Revolution, and you calculate GDP for those countries for which we had the data. In this particular case, it's using 1985 dollars. Japan was a very poor country. It was a feudal society. There was the time of the samurai. And you can see that at that time, the UK and Australia were much richer countries than Japan. A little more than 100 years later, by 2021, the difference between Japan and UK and Australia has been essentially eliminated. They have, you know, broadly the same magnitude. And so this is a very interesting story. You know, how did Japan catch up in a little more than a century, you know, with the levels of income seen in the very richest countries of the 19th century? And the story here is that the countries that were at the center of global capitalism did the most to open their economies to international trade, to investment, and they benefited from technological progress. And Japan in particular in the 19th century went into a remarkable period of opening up to the rest of the world, importing technologies, copying the best practices, and including the legal system from European countries. There's a very interesting story there. There was an economy minister by the name of Toshimishi, who led a delegation and went on a very long business trip. I think it took something like 3 years. He was traveling all over the world, visiting factories in you know, textile factories in England, visiting Germany. You know, essentially observing and shamelessly copying, although I use that word not in a critical way, perhaps I should say openly copying, some of the best things that he could see, because he did not wish Japan to become or to remain a colony of the big industrial powers. He wanted Japan to become an independent country, self-sufficient, and so he came back and he adopted a lot of the things that he learned from his visit to the rich countries of the West. Now, in the next page, I'm going to show you a kind of an interesting little dynamic exercise that we did with one of my research assistants at the World Bank. If we could go to the next slide. You know that a former colleague of mine a few years ago wrote an article in the Financial Times in which he made the following point. He said, if you look at what has been happening to economic growth over the last 20 years, the poorest countries in Africa, for instance, have been growing twice as fast as the countries in the rich industrial world. This was actually literally true. And therefore, he said, we have solved the problem of inequality, because this means that if we just wait, the low-income countries, the poor countries in Africa, are going to catch up in their standards of living with the Germanys and the Americas and the Canadas and the Japans of the world. And he concluded this piece by saying, we have solved the problem of inequality because convergence, catching up, is going to is going to take over. And to me, I read that piece, and it seemed to me that there was something that was fundamentally missing in the argument, and which was, how long is it going to take for the low-income countries to catch up with the high-income countries, right? I played a little game in my own mind, and I said, let me pretend that I am the finance minister of a country in sub-Saharan Africa, let's say Ghana, and one day one of my assistants comes and tells me, Mr. Lopez Claros, I want to tell you that I will leave my employment with you, and I will move to Sweden because I have a cousin who lives there, and he has told me that life is good in Sweden and that there are many job opportunities and that income is much higher. In fact, my cousin in Sweden is sending money to all his relatives here in Ghana and helping them in a big way to become more prosperous and to build themselves a little house and so on and so forth. So I want to do the same. And so having just read the article in the Financial Times by this IMF economist, I tell my assistant, oh, no, don't go. Stay here because according to this IMF economist, we, Ghana, is catching up. We have been growing at twice the speed of Sweden, and therefore you just have to stick around for a little while longer, and our standards of living are going to be similar to those of Sweden, right? But I think that the assistant decides to not take my advice and leaves anyway and travels to Sweden. And so what this little exercise here does is the following. It says, well, first of all, I want to make you observe something. The high-income countries, you know, countries like Canada, Japan, Italy, U.S., etc., they have an average GDP per capita of something like $48,000. The low-income countries have a GDP per capita of about $700 per year. And so let me focus your attention on scenario one. If you look at the data for the last 20 years, it turns out that the high-income countries have grown by an average of 2.6%, whereas the low-income countries have grown by about 4.7%, so which is not quite twice as fast, but you know it's clearly nearly there. And so the premise of my colleague at the IMF was correct. You know, the low-income countries have been growing much faster than the high-income countries. All right, so what you do is the following. You ask the question, how long is it going to take for the low-income countries to catch up with the high-income countries? And so you just crank out the computer and you say, let's assume that they continue to grow for the foreseeable future at the same rate. In other words, the low-income countries continue to grow at 4.7 on average and the high-income countries at 2.6. And of course, you could argue and say, oh, but that's not realistic because we know that climate change is going to hit the low-income countries especially harshly because they are dependent on agriculture and so on. And I will tell you, yes, that's probably true. This is probably not a reasonable assumption, but let's use it as a working assumption. Let's just assume and crank out the numbers. Well, it turns out, and this is perhaps going to surprise you a little bit, that that gap between 48,000 for the high-income countries and 700 for the low-income countries, in fact, widens for many, many years to come. And you might say, well, that's counterintuitive. How could the gap widen if the high-income countries are growing faster? The low-income countries are growing faster than the high-income countries. And the reason the gap widens is because 48,000 is so much higher than $700 that even if you apply a smaller percentage, 2.6 to $48,000, that is still a much higher number than applying 4.7% to $705. All right. And so, not to bore you with the details, it turns out that the gap widens until the year 2197. And there is finally convergence, a catching up, in the year 2226, right? So the intuition of my assistant of wanting to go to Sweden anyway and not wait 200 years was quite correct, right? The next, we're going to skip the next charts, which is basically just a pictorial show of what I had just told you in words, all right? So we'll skip a couple of slides in the interest of time because I want to get a little bit. Oh, this is an interesting, you know, Todd talked about the Gini coefficient, and you can see that the Gini coefficient between the years, this is the world Gini coefficient, right? Todd talked about the Gini coefficient for the U.S., but at the World Bank, we calculated a Gini coefficient for the whole world, for all 8 billion people in the world. And what we discovered is that this coefficient had been coming down gradually since 1990, but it was reversed for the first time in many, many years during COVID, which is the little orange dotted line that you see rising after COVID. And that was a kind of an interesting implication of the pandemic. Let's go to the next slide. And one more. Okay, this is an interesting chart that shows you, it's kind of an intuitive exercise. Let's suppose that you line up all the people in the world in a big long highway, and you put the richest people at one end, so you're going to see, you know, the billionaires, the tech billionaires at the very top, and then you know, many miles down the road, you're going to see the poorest people, and then you ask yourself, what percent of the world's population do I need to generate the first 20% of income? And it turns out that you need 75% of the world's population to generate the first what's called a quintile, the first 20% of income. At the other extreme, where the rich people are located, you only need 1.7% of the world's population to generate 20% of world income. This is another take on some of the interesting data that was shown by Todd, essentially saying the same thing, except that I am focusing on the whole world, whereas his focus was largely the U.S., all right? Let's skip a couple of slides. one of the things that you might want to ask is, well, you know, what are some of the things that countries have done to address the problem of inequality? Because if you look at Gini coefficients for the whole world, and we have data for 100 plus countries, including the US, which is what Todd showed, what you see is that Gini coefficients vary quite a bit, actually. You know, some of the highest are located in Latin America and in Africa. And the region of the world that has the lowest Gini coefficients, which means the lowest levels of income inequality, is actually the European Union. You have countries like Sweden, Norway, Denmark, France, and so on, that have among the lowest Gini coefficients in the world. In other words, the lowest levels of inequality. And so that immediately raises a very interesting question. What is it that these countries have done that have allowed them to have more equitable societies where, yes, there is inequality, but not quite to the same extent as countries like in Latin America or even the United States, which has very high levels of inequality? And so what I like to mention is three or four of these things quickly, because I'm looking at my watch and I want to be respectful of your time. And also, I'm logging in from Madrid, and so for me, it is a little bit past 1:15 in the morning, and I'm keeping not to go to bed too late this evening. All right. So one thing is that many of the countries that have succeeded in reducing income inequality have used the tax system in a fairly proactive way. You know, they have progressive tax rates, and they have used the budget as a mechanism of distribution, right? Where you tax high incomes more than your tax law incomes, or in many countries you exempt a significant share of the country's population with low incomes from paying any tax at all, right? You know, like if your income is below so many euros or so many krone or whatever the currency, then you are exempt from paying income tax. But if you are wealthy, you pay more. In some countries, you know, you may find this is a little humorous, but in Finland, for instance, if you're caught speeding, the size of your penalty is linked to your income. And there is a very celebrated, very famous case of a billionaire in Finland that was caught speeding, and he had to pay a ticket that was something like $300,000 or the equivalent of that, right? You might say, oh, that is outrageous. How could that be? But, you know, it is a way in which you tax the very wealthy in order to use those resources for redistribution. And I must mention in passing that some of these countries with very low Gini coefficients, low levels of inequality, have extremely good educational systems. They have extremely good performance of students in international tests of, knowledge, sort of reading, understanding, math and scientific understanding and so on. And of course, they have very extensive safety nets that provide security. Everybody has access to health, and they have excellent infrastructure as well. You know, because of my work, I travel extensively in Europe, and I assure you, I don't mean disrespect for the United States, but for instance, the road infrastructure in much of Europe is really much, much better than what you see in America. And I think it's partly because the tax system, you know, manages to return a lot of the tax collection through investments in infrastructure, education, public health, and so on. So that's one mechanism in which you can have a lower inequality. I think that the safety net is an important component of that. When for instance, in the area of health, you know, when you have a system that provides health security independently of your level of income, because it is a benefit allocated to 100% of the population, then of course, you know, you have a safety net that protects everybody and that prevents, you know, extreme poverty, prevents hunger, and so on. There are virtually no extremely poor people in some of these countries as you have them in Africa and Latin America and in other parts of the world. Okay, so let me give you a couple more examples of things that contribute to reduce income inequality. If you could skip a couple of slides, please. One more. Okay, this is a very interesting slide, and you might find it actually, can we go back to the previous slide? I apologize. You know, the IMF does an accounting of the extent to which countries subsidize energy, gasoline, natural gas, coal, electricity, across the world. They have data for, you know, the whole, you know, pretty much, you know, most of the countries in the world. And what is really interesting about energy subsidies is that they are enormous in scope. Something like 7% of GDP or world GDP. And in the next slide, what I will show you is the top left-hand corner. This is the gasoline subsidy. And what you can see here is that 60% of the gasoline subsidy is allocated to the 20% of the richest part of the population. Why? Because these subsidies tend to be general. They tend to be not targeted to the poor, but they are just general subsidies. Anybody can buy cheap gasoline. And guess who buys the cheap gasoline? it's the people who have the cars who drive in the cities, and cheap energy, they buy cheap gas to heat up their homes, and their homes tend to be much larger than the homes of poor people living in the countryside or in the rural areas. And so the subsidies actually worsen income inequality. It's a very, very terrible public policy. Not only do they worsen income inequality, but they also, of course, contribute to climate change, to accelerating climate change, because they stimulate consumption of energy because of the of the subsidy. When energy is cheap, you tend to overuse it. So here is one potential area where we could do a great deal to reduce inequality in the world, you know, by not subsidizing energy. And an added benefit of that would be that we would also mitigate climate change in an important way. And next slide. This is a really fascinating chart. I am very proud to show it to you because this was actually put together by one of my teams at the World Bank. I was the head of one of the research departments at the World Bank, and one of my teams put together, built up a database with the number of discriminations against women embedded in the laws of countries. So you look at the constitution, the civil code, the labor code, the tax code, the company law. There's half a dozen pieces of legislation which in many countries actually discriminate against women and turn them into second-class citizens. So, for instance, Iran, to pick an example. Iran is a very a particularly nasty little country where if you look at the legislation, we were able to find 27 different forms in which Iranian legislation discriminates against women. You know, you look at the particular article in the civil code, and even if you're not a lawyer, you read that article and you say, oh, yes, of course, that that actually discriminates very overtly against women. Iran is also a country that discriminates against religious minorities in ways that are extremely cruel and unfair and in violation of you know, their commitments, their international law commitments under the UN Charter and other legal instruments. They are especially nasty against the Baha'i community, which is the largest religious minority in Iran. Now, why do I mention this? Because in this chart, what you see is from left to right, you see in the number of discriminations against women. So you will have countries like Iran on the extreme left. And as you move to the right, you have countries where, you know, like Netherlands and New Zealand and Canada and, you know, countries in Northern Europe that have no discrimination, zero. We were not able to find any form of discrimination against women in the legislation, right? Now, why do I bring this as an issue of inequality? Because we discovered that, and I'll show you the next slide, please, that once you have a number for a country, which is the number of discrimination against women, what we discovered is that the higher the number of discriminations, the lower the school enrollment rate of girls in secondary school, the lower the labor force participation rate of women, the lower the number of women-owned businesses, and so on. And I don't have time to go into more sort of details in this study, but we did see, I think there is a slide actually, and the next one, where you look at this is a slightly different slide. But to conclude on gender, you know, I'll give you a fairly graphic example of why there is a very direct connection between gender discrimination on the one hand and an inequality on the other. In Russia, we were able to identify 456 different occupations which are forbidden to women. From not being able to drive the metro trains in a very extensive system of metro that they have in Russia, to dozens and dozens of jobs in the energy sector. Russia is an energy producing country where women simply cannot access these occupations. And of course, especially because these occupations are highly paid, when half of the population doesn't have access to a lot of very highly paid jobs in the economy, it will not surprise you that this will, of course, worsen in income inequality. It could contribute to a wage gap between men and women, but it will also, of course, worsen income inequality in the society at large. All right. So here you have another example, countries that have managed to eliminate discrimination against women, encourage their integration into the job force, educated girls so that they reach the age of adulthood and then can join the labor force because they have the skills, those countries tend to have lower Gini coefficients. And then finally, this last graph basically shows you that countries that have a more friendly business regulation and more friendly business environment, where the government doesn't discourage entrepreneurship but actually encourages entrepreneurship, are also countries that have lower Gini coefficients. Okay, I will stop here, and I apologize for perhaps having extended a little bit, but I did want to share with you this international perspective. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much, Augusto. Thank you very much. We have time for one question. I know. Who is the lucky?
So I went to, is this on? Testing 1, 2, 3. I went to China in 1988 to help with their very first cochlear implant. And in downtown Beijing, there were all 1 and 2 story buildings and people blocked toilets because there was no running water. People were living in poverty. And obviously the government changed and the things took in a very dramatic way. And now, of course, it's very prosperous and amazing country with all kinds of technology and equality in finances.
Thank you for the comment. And we're just on time, so I want to thank you all for coming. We hope to see you all for our final two programs, the Glocal at Iowa, Me, Iowa, the World, next Friday, and how does too much presidential power endanger democracy on November 14th? Thank you so much, Todd and Augusta, for this excellent discussion. Wish we had more time to really discuss, but please give them another round of applause.